AMU podcast in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Radio X, Google, consent decrees and Sam Smith. I am CMU editor Andy Malt. In this same very room with me right now, instead of wherever it is you've been, is Chris Cook, business editor of CMU. Hello, Chris.
I am back in London. And the sun is out. The sun is shining for my gallant return to this fair city and to the studio that actually hosts the CMU podcast.
The gallant return to London with your interview with the bakery that Harry Styles used to work in.
Mandeville's in Holmes Chapel.
Yeah. Have you got that?
Well, I set out on Saturday morning.
Did you?
I did. I left the house and I set along Middlewich Road, is the road that takes you from that house to Mandeville's. And then on my way there, I decided to get my hair cut instead. So
you have had a haircut, yeah.
If this was a video podcast, then I think our viewers, as they would be, would get the benefit of that, because I've got quite a smart haircut.
From
the barbers in Holmes Chapel. Mm. And after I'd done that, I felt, well, with my new haircut, I don't care what the bakers in Holmes Chapel. I had a new confidence. It's like my opinion is more important about the future of Harry Styles' solo career post One Direction hiatus. So I didn't go to the bakery.
Well, you also promised some iced buns.
I did.
And you've not got those either.
No, I ate them. But they were good.
Oh, so you did go.
They were good.
You did go to the bakery.
I didn't get them from that bakery. I got them from a different shop, and they were very good. I ate them on the train on my way back to London. So I had a very pleasant weekend, I think, is the conclusion of this conversation, and I'm sure our listeners will be glad to hear that.
So I'm not so sure. I think you've really let them down. I think you should apologise.
Well, I'm here.
Yes.
So what they won't have to tolerate this week is my voice sort of going, well, I suppose I could still do this and like that, and perhaps my voice will be all over the place. But hopefully on this edition, there won't be a crackly phone line. There won't be some slightly sort of peaking bits because I didn't set up my laptop right when I was recording my bits. Although I think last week's record from my parents' study actually worked quite well.
Yeah, so you could go back there and you could get all the stuff you promised done.
Okay, well, perhaps at some point
next
in the coming weeks.
Next week, Chris Cook will have the interview with Harry Styles' former employer. Next week.
Is this going to be a regular feature?
I'm going to just every week.
If this
now.
Is going to be a regular feature, I might reinstate the comedy drink of the week feature. So that's something for us to look forward to on future editions.
I've got a coffee.
So shall we talk about the bloody music industry? Well, actually, really, we're going to start off by talking about the bloody radio industry.
Yeah, which is way more fun. Because some radio industry things have happened this week. As we discussed briefly last week, when it was still but a rumour, or a pretty certain rumour, well, an absolutely certain rumour, considering what I'm about to say, is XFM is dead. Long live Radio X.
Yes, XFM is relaunching as Radio X. And in my write-up on this earlier in the week, I think I did sort of declare the death of XFM. I wasn't the only person doing that. XFM RIP. Was doing the rounds.
Well, that was sort of how it was positioned.
It's interesting.
In the press release.
Yes, and it was in the press release, various celebrity presenters who are now joining what was XFM, what will be Radio X as of next week. So we had Johnny Vaughan, we had Vaughan, what's he called? Vernon Kay. We had Ricky Wilson off of Kaiser Chiefs and The Voice fame. They're all going to be doing shows on the new station.
And Chris Moyles.
And, of course, Chris Moyles. Although there wasn't a quote from Chris Moyles. He'd been too busy making a silly little YouTube video over the weekend to submit his quote. I am assuming that's why there wasn't a quote from Moyles. And so Johnny Vaughan and Vernon Kay. I have a real mental block on Vernon Kay's name. I think that's probably, I don't know.
Two people with V's in their name next to each other. That's unusual, isn't it?
So they were both talking about Radio X as if it was a brand new radio station. We're very excited to be on this brand new radio
station.
Which
then made Ricky Wilson's quote look slightly odd because he was going, oh yeah, XFM supported our band right from the beginning. It's been really, really great to us. XFM, you know, and it's been so important for lots of bands kind of working their way up the ranks of the music industry. But then in a press release, it was basically saying XFM is dead. That did seem a bit odd. But it turns out Ricky Wilson was the only person who got it right.
It's true that the press release and the statements from the new celebrity presenters did not talk at all about the heritage of this radio station. And this radio station has a great heritage.
They probably didn't know about it.
It's been going for nearly 20 years and, you know, has always been unusual as a commercial radio station. I mean, people often make comparisons these days with Six Music and sort of say, oh, Six Music does a lot of the stuff that perhaps XFM either did do or certainly aspired to do. 2 back in the early days. And obviously, Six Music came after XFM and stole quite a lot of its presenters. So, yeah. So there are some parallels between XFM and Six Music. But XFM's a commercial station. It's not a BBC thing. So it's run on much tighter budgets, because commercial radio generally is. And it's done great things over the years. Had some great shows. It's specialist shows. I mean, Exposure, which has been going since day one. I mean, there can't be very many specialist shows that have been going that long. And no. And continue to be. I mean, John Kennedy.
And since, you know, since XFM launched as a pirate station as well, not like it wasn't always a commercial venture. And John Kennedy has been there throughout.
Since the start. And continues to produce incredibly good radio 4 nights a week. So it is a station with a great heritage. And so therefore it was interesting that when the press release came out, it was very much sort of, we're new radio station, Radio X. They then sort of bigged up, which I think within the music community wrangled a little. They bigged up how this was going to have a particular focus towards a male audience.
Yes.
And you know, understandably, lots of people took to social networks and sort of like, what the hell does that mean? If this is meant to be a music radio station, how can music be skewed towards men? Although, I mean, I think I said to you when that press release came in, that sort of radio speak in the radio world, people do talk about stations skewing male or skewing female. Actually, when you then look at the audience figures, I mean, generally...
Probably more
media,
like 60-40.
Well, or even less than that, 55-45. So when you talk about a station, I think the radio industry would say Heart is a radio station that skews female. But that doesn't mean that 90% of its listeners are female at all. So it's a bit of a sort of a way radio people talk about their demographics. But it was interesting how it didn't, other than Ricky Wilson, it didn't talk about the station's heritage, which made it feel like this is going to be a brand new radio station. There have been plenty of rumours about music policy. The press release said very little about music policy, except that the strapline's got music in it. More music here, get music.
It's not a very memorable thing, but it definitely said
has
music
the word music
in it.
Although the press release talks much more about the presenters and the chat, and obviously, you know, Chris Moyles is famous for during his tenure on the Radio 1 Breakfast Show as being a Radio 1 Breakfast Show presenter, you know, on the pop music station for young people, who actually didn't play that much pop music and didn't really speak to young people.
No.
Johnny Vaughan is also known for being a very sort of gabby radio presenter. So you sort of sensed from the press release this station was going to be more about the personalities and the chat. It didn't really talk about music policy. There have been rumours over the summer this was going to be more of an absolute type station. I mean, the one rumour that was doing the rounds, I have no idea if this was true, and thank God it didn't happen, was that they were going to call it Capital Rocks.
Yeah.
Because, of course, when they rebranded Choice, it became Capital Extra. Is that what that station's now called?
Yeah.
And so there was talk that they were going to rebrand XFM as Capital Rocks. That hasn't happened. They've just basically got rid of the FM. I assume because this is going to go out nationally on digital and online, and they're going to make a big deal about that. And I think some people in radio are a bit squeamish once you take a station off the FM dial, should you use the word FM? I mean, I think people just think of FM as meaning radio, don't they?
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be on the FM frequency. But anyway, that's the rebrand. As we understand it, actually, the music policy is not going to radically change. And because we were thinking if daytime was more like an absolute rock, classic rock type station, but then you still have got John Kennedy in the evening on Exposure, and some of the other specialist shows are staying, would that sound a bit odd? Those would be two different radio stations. But as we understand it, daytime, in terms of the music being played, is going to have quite a lot of what you had on XFM before, so championing new artists, bigging up new artists. And actually, the hope is these big-name celebrities, real hardcore music fans might not relish the thought of waking up to Chris Moyles or driving home to Johnny Vaughan, but they're big personalities who could bring in a much, much bigger audience than XFM ever had.
And bringing in a big audience is what advertisers want.
Indeed. And ultimately, the new artists, the XFM champions, they quite like a big audience.
Because
if you're being championed by a radio station, it's good if they're championing you.
But
to
in terms
lots of
kind of bringing in advertisers saying, look, we've got this brand new radio station, forget about that other one. That's not it. It's new and it's got all these big personalities. Please give us money.
Yes. So I think it will be interesting to see how it turns out. And as I did say in my article in the CMU Daily, commercial radio is often criticised for not having any decent personalities. So quite often what happens on commercial radio, because commercial radio operates on tiny budgets, is they might put a bit of effort into breakfast. But beyond the breakfast show, you generally have people who don't have much personality, who don't say a lot, they just press a button, they introduce records. And people always say, oh, commercial radio should have more big, chatty people to give the station a bit of a personality and a bit of feel to it. And to be fair, that is what this lineup is. And whether or not you like to listen to Chris Moyles or Vernon Kay or Johnny Vaughan, they are chatty personalities. And I think if Global was revamping Capital this way, most people in the music industry would be saying, oh, that's great, they're ingesting some personality. But I think it was because this was a station that had such a good heritage, and it really felt from the announcement that they were basically cutting all of that and starting afresh with new. That's why I think the reaction in the music community, certainly what I saw, was either hesitant or outright critical of this move. But I think it will be interesting to see what Radio X sounds like when it goes live.
Well, that's a radio station getting a revamp, really, whereas the BBC is planning to give Radio a massive overhaul by launching its own streaming service, maybe.
Yes. So when Apple said it was going to launch a streaming service, it launched a radio station. And when the BBC has a radio station, it's going to turn it into a streaming service or something like that. So this was a big report that the BBC put out.
Yeah, it's basically its report saying a wish list of things it would do if it gets all the funding it wants from the government next year, which it won't. But it's basically it's a long document that outlines everything it would do if it had the money to do it. One of which is this music streaming service, which would give kind of time limited access to the songs that they're playing on the radio at the time. So about I think it would refresh every month. There'd be about 50,000 songs at a time. It would kind of big up more niche artists and things like the Live Lounge recordings, which are obviously exclusive to the BBC anyway, so as not to compete too much with commercial digital ventures. It was reported like a foregone conclusion, but I think it is very much a this could happen.
Yeah, so I suppose basically how it would work is if you would go on the website, and I don't know, it would have Pete Tong's playlist from last week's show.
It's built, or we should say, built kind of with BBC Playlist as its basis, and then it's sort of an expansion of that.
Yeah, so whereas at the moment, if you go onto the Playlister service that the BBC runs, you can see the playlist from Pete Tong's show, click a button, and it can take you to Spotify or Deezer, and then you can listen to the records on those services. So what they're sort of saying is, well, we'd ramp this up a level, and you'd actually be able to go into our website, look at the playlist, and either listen to Pete Tong's radio show as it went out last week, as you already can on iPlayer Radio, or you could say, oh, I just want to listen to that record. Or you could go into several specialist shows, pick out some records that the DJs have been recommending, and then create your own playlist and listen to it through the BBC interface. So, it's sort of ramping up Playlister so that rather than just being a big lists of curated music that you can then go and listen to elsewhere, you could actually do it within the BBC interface. I mean, interestingly, when they first talked about Playlister a few years ago, before it actually launched, there were plenty of rumours that this was what they were going to do, that they were basically going to move into streaming and they were going to sort of pull all of the sessions out of the archive and sort of prom concerts that they're sitting on. And I think that was also part of what they proposed in the report earlier this week, that as well as having music that is being playlisted on their shows, they would sort of pull content that they had recorded out of their archives and present it through their own interface. As you say, I mean, this report had lots of sort of wild proposals, including shutting down BBC News Channel, shutting down BBC Four, getting rid of CBBC and CBeebies and revamping them as a sort of on-demand platform. So there was some quite radical proposals in this document, and it's very forward-looking. So the BBC is getting a new royal charter from Parliament, and as you say, it was sort of like, well, what we would like to do in the time period of the next charter, which will be, you know, a number of years. So it's not that this is launching next week. It's something that they're considering doing. But it does throw up a number of questions for the music industry, which is, you know, will this screw over Spotify? Because that's a problem for the music industry if it does. And also, how the hell are they going to license this service?
Well, the wording of the report was very interesting. Obviously, they have to justify why the BBC should build such a thing. In the report, it talked up how important BBC's music on radio, TV has been to the music industry, and how important the music industry is to BBC Radio. And also then, kind of, as I said, talking about the kind of pushing niche music so as not to encroach on the both commercial radio and stream, you know, commercial streaming services.
Because it's interesting with the Playlist, a service that currently exists, and we talked about this at The Great Escape, because we had the guy who oversees Playlist at the BBC speaking as one of the CMU strands at The Great Escape, and he admitted the Playlist as it currently is set up is interesting in that it takes all of the curation from BBC Radio and then points people off to Spotify and Deezer and services like that. And so you could almost argue that in that, the BBC is taking its brands and its people and its audience and is then saying, stop listening to radio, go and listen to music over here. So the BBC, I think, as it currently stands with Playlister, is very much helping the, you know, the emerging streaming music service. Mm. And I think probably Spotify and Deezer, etc., would recognise that. This is then sort of ramping up to the next level. And on the, from the BBC side, you could see, well, why is the BBC, you know, offering all these curation tools and then immediately punting people over there? But from the Spotify Deezer side, the minute you can actually listen to the music within the BBC platform, they might start to say, well, hang on a second, you started off helping us by helping us with curation and shunting people in our direction. Now you're competing with us. And OK, you're saying there'll be limitations because the music won't be there forever. It'll only be there for limited time and blah, blah, blah.
And they're saying it would give users kind of the means to shunt their playlists out to other services like Spotify, Deezer, etc.
That element would still be there. But I suppose the question is, would people need to use that part of the service if they could actually access the content now through the BBC platform?
No, because especially like, I mean, I suppose stuff like, you know, the hottest record in the world right now, Playlist. People are probably listening to that as it goes live.
Right now.
Yeah, right.
In fact.
While the records are still hot.
Yeah. Who wants to listen to cold records?
So a month later, that's, you know, no one's going to listen to that playlist.
And of course, whenever the BBC starts sort of treading on the territory of commercial content companies, particularly once you get beyond straight TV and radio, so the BBC starts moving into other areas, which arguably is not within its, you know, core remit. That's not what the licence fee is for. And certainly, you know, the newspapers, I mean, obviously the newspapers have various reasons why they don't like the BBC, but one of the reasons why newspapers don't like the BBC is because through the BBC News website, you know, the BBC became a publisher as well as a broadcaster. And newspaper owners would say the BBC has no right to be a publisher. That's not what the BBC is for. And you will have noticed that the BBC News website in recent years has been cutting back on the non-audio video content. You know, increasingly you go in there and you have to watch a video because that's the newspapers saying it's not your job to be a publisher. And so whereas Spotify and Deezer, etc., to date have been champions of Playlister because they recognise the benefits, they might start to say, hang on a second, it's not the job of the BBC to become a streaming service, an on-demand streaming service. By all means, stream your radio shows on demand, but you shouldn't be a single-track service because that's what we do over here. And although the BBC likes to talk about how much money it puts into the music industry through PPL and PRS, and it does, okay, which is one of the reasons why the music industry is such a big champion of the licence fee. It's an important revenue stream for record companies and publishers in this country. However, they're not paying anything like what the Spotify's and Deezer's are paying for those on-demand listens, which I suppose brings us to the licensing element of this. Yeah. There seems to be some disconnect or confusion about how exactly the services the BBC have been described would be licensed by the music industry.
Yeah, because that report very much kind of positions it as, oh, this is something that the music industry is very keen to work with us on. It would be mutually beneficial for all of us, and the music industry is right behind us. But then it was the BPI AGM yesterday, where the BPI boss, Jeff Taylor, stood up on stage and said, no, we don't like the way the BBC is proposing to license this, which is basically by not licensing it. And we're not happy with this at all, and kind of really shot it down.
Yes, given that, you know, another theme at that AGM, given you had John Whittingdale, the culture minister, in the room, was the music industry saying, the BBC is important, don't kill the BBC, Mr. Terrible Tory in the room. They didn't call him Terrible Tory in the room. They said, what a great guy you are. Here, have a present. Don't screw over BBC music. But you know, given the mood was, we must keep the BBC, we must continue to fund the BBC, it's great for music, he was then sort of saying, but on this point, and you sense that there has been, I mean, who knows what conversations have gone on behind the scenes, that it has been suggested by the BBC that this is something that could sit under the licences they have from the collecting societies, from PPL on the label side and PRS on the publisher-songwriter side. And it could just be an add-on, and perhaps there would be a little fee for that add-on, but that it wouldn't be a serious licensing deal like a Spotify and a Deezer has. And you sort of sense Jeff Taylor from the label's perspective was saying, no, this can't just be added on the bottom of your PPL license. This would have to be really thought out.
Yes, you'd have to go and do direct licenses like any streaming service would do, rather than obviously at the moment radio and all their online stuff, Listen Again, is all done through the same collective license that, you know, just covers everything. So that's a battle I think the BBC possibly wouldn't necessarily be expecting to be quite such a big deal as it is going to become, especially as the, you know, the music industry becomes more and more committed to shouting about people trying to operate services without licenses. Like, you know, we've seen, we discussed last week about the battle with SoundCloud,
etc. So, and I think, you know, the thing we started off by saying is, well, would a ramped up playlister help or hinder a Spotify would be crucial to any talks they then had with the labels. If they could convince the labels that this will help get more paying subscribers to the streaming services, then they might be willing to cut a favourable deal. If there's any fear that this could stop people from paying to subscribe to Spotify and Deezer, then they would see it as a competitor, and then they would be looking for much more like market rates. So assuming this does go ahead and it's not just some proposal that gets lost, because I suspect a lot of what is in that report will get lost down the line. But if we assume that this isn't one of them, well, it'll be interesting to see what deals can or cannot be done down the line.
Returning to a topic we covered in some detail recently, safe harbours. You went to an event this week, didn't you? What was that event?
I went to the Westminster Media Forum.
I actually knew that. I was fashioning some intrigue.
And well done.
Did you like it?
Which organised regular events on media issues, and I was in a room full mainly of lawyers and licensing people, so that was fun. There was a lot of them,
though. The best kinds of people.
There was a lot of them. The guy from the Premier League was good. He was very outspoken. I need to find a reason to get him to The Great Escape, because he was he did not mince his words in discussing the copyright side of football and football screenings and such like. But basically, the whole debate was looking at the current review of copyright law in Europe, okay, because there are various things going on in Brussels, which means that copyright law in the European Union is up for review. And so it was various people, mainly rights owners, so the, you know, the TV people, film people, Premier League as owners of IP and the football matches, and the music industry were there. You had a few users of content, the Open Rights Group were there. Libraries Trade Group was there, and it was everybody sort of throwing in their opinions on what should be the priority for the European Commission and the European Union as they reform copyright law. And there's this digital single market that gets talked about a lot, and sort of the copyright elements of that. So everybody got their moment to stand up, and it was interesting. It was one of those events where sort of everyone sort of spoke separately, and so it was like basically each copyright industry standing up and saying, this is what they're proposing to change, and they shouldn't. Everything's fine. The film industry were like, everything's fine. Because geo-blocking is one of the topics that has come up. So, that, you know the various things about the fact that some films are available online legitimately in some countries but not other countries, depending on how licensing deals have been done. And then obviously you have geo-blocking, so that if you take your Netflix into France, perhaps it doesn't work, or you access different content, and so on and so forth. And it was, all the rights owners were like, there are no problems. What do you mean there are problems? We've sorted out all the problems. You know, the people in Brussels should just, you know, leave us be, was the basic message. And then the Open Rights Group and the library people stand up with massive long lists of things that they were saying, this isn't working, this isn't working, this needs to change. So I'm not sure much consensus was reached. But I think the thing that I found interesting out of the whole thing was that Frances Lowe, who, and let me get her job title right, is Head of Legal Policy and Public Affairs at PRS, the Performing Rights Society, was the main speaker for the music industry. And unsurprisingly, given conversations we've had on recent editions of the podcast, we know that for the PRS, safe harbours is the big legislative issue at the moment. And the SoundCloud litigation also sort of fits into this area as well. And we've talked on the podcast before about how for the music industry, this seems to have become the issue of 2015. So the record industry are talking about it, the publishers are talking about it, and PRS in particular have become very vocal on this issue. So the fact that there are these lines in both US and European copyright law that says that ISPs and server companies and similar companies whose customers use their servers or their internet connection to infringe copyright can't be held liable for the copyright infringement, providing they have a takedown system. That's what the safe harbors say. The music industry are pissed off that things like YouTube and SoundCloud and Dailymotion use those safe harbours too, which is how you can have a YouTube and a SoundCloud service, which is an opt-out rather than opt-in service. That's all I'm going to say about the safe harbours, because we've talked about
it before. We've discussed it at length before.
So you can go and look that up on the website, or there's actually, if you go to the trends report section of the website, so /trends, there's a Safe Harbour trends article that we published earlier in the year, which is currently available for free, even though it should only be available to premium users. So for all the background, go and read that article.
So before we sort that out, yes. Go and read it.
No, it's deliberately free.
I know it's deliberately free.
It's not that we've screwed up.
I was fashioning some intrigue.
Were you? You're very into that today. I can sense it. But what was interesting was, you know, the PRS representative stood up, talked about safe harbours. That wasn't a surprise. She spoke. It was a very interesting speech. Actually, it was probably one of the most engaging speeches of the morning. The arguments were quite clear cut. I think PRS have really worked out what their line is on all of this. They didn't mention the SoundCloud litigation much, other than that it's happening. Obviously, that's live lawsuit, so they couldn't go into that in any great detail. But all about safe harbours. So that was great. But what was interesting was that nobody else who got on stage during the morning mentioned safe harbours. Okay, and for the film industry and for the TV industry and for the sports industry, it was all about geo-blocking, as I say. And they were saying, Europe, don't reform copyright law. All this geo-blocking stuff's nonsense. It's all fine. We're fixing everything. Keep your hands off our copyright law. So it was then interesting to see PRS stand up and say, actually, we would like you to meddle. Yeah. There's something we'd like you to change. And so I just thought that was interesting because, I mean, earlier in the year, when it became clear that for both the labels and the publishers, safe harbours was the issue of 2015, and most music industry trade bodies are now backing this, which in itself is sometimes unusual because often there is disconnect in the music industry. Most people are saying that in Europe we should review the safe harbours rules and have a look, you know, should a YouTube and a SoundCloud be allowed to sort of, you know, circumvent some liabilities for the content that gets uploaded using these safe harbours. And I was speaking to a lawyer earlier in the year and saying, do you think they're going to get the law changed? Because you have to remember that Google is a phenomenal lobby. Google obviously do not want this law changing because if it would hugely hinder the YouTube business model. And Google's argument is the safe harbours are fine. We've built Content ID, you know, all of the moans that the music industry has. Content ID, you know, addresses all of those issues. So shut up, keep the law as it is. We'll carry on regardless. And Google is an incredible lobby. Someone told me, I don't know if this is true.
But say it anyway.
I'll say it anyway. That in the US, if you put all of the music industry's various lobbyists together, so the in-house lobbyists at the big music companies and at the collecting societies and at the trade bodies and the people that they have on retainer in agencies, if you were to put them all in one building in Washington, it would be about, you know, it would be a sort of small to middle-sized lobbying agency's worth of people. Okay, Google have 4 retained lobbying agencies in Washington, this person told me. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I was told. So, you know, Google have a massive lobbying effort. So I said to a lawyer earlier in the year, do you think even the music industry speaking as one for once on this issue, can they get this changed? And he said, well, if they could unite with the other content industries so that it was TV and film and sport and music all saying to Brussels, this is a massive problem, you have to sort it out, then perhaps they could. Perhaps they could swing against the tech giants and get their way. But it's clear that that ain't going to happen. I'm not saying that TV and film and sport would be against the PRS's proposal.
But what this event showed was that the music industry is totally out of sync with everyone else, which is interesting in itself because, you know, the government tends to bundle the copyright industry as one thing. They're all the same.
Especially at a European level, when they're reviewing widespread legislation, they are prone to say, yes, the copyright industries, the content industries, the entertainment industries. And so whether or not the music industry, without the weight of the TV, film and sports people, you know, shouting on their behalf, and that Premier League guy who was very outspoken, I think his voice would be heard in Brussels. It'll be interesting to see whether or not that means that they can get this on the agenda and whether they can take on Google and the other tech giants lobbyists who will be busy, you know, saying this is not a problem, do not change it. And as far as Google is concerned, they'll just keep on saying Content ID, Content ID, Content ID. And I know someone who had spoken to Google's lobbyists in the UK, again, I do not have this firsthand, but they said actually Google don't even seem particularly bothered about this at the moment. They genuinely think that nothing's going to change. And that, whether or not that's just bluff and you know, because it was talking to somebody externally, I don't know. But as the review of copyright law in Europe continues over the next 6 or 7 months, it will be interesting to see whether or not the music industry can even get safe harbours high enough up the agenda that it gets properly considered. And then if they do, whether they can battle Google, etc. on this one.
Now, speaking of Google and safe harbours, there was a little stat came out this week that was quite interesting. Torrent Freak did some punching of its calculator and worked out that as of last month, Google was processing 23 takedown notices per second.
So the takedown notices are the other side of safe harbours, and Google generally operates under the American copyright law on this. So the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in the US says Google has these safe harbours, providing they have a takedown system that if a copyright owner spots a bit of content or a link to a bit of content that is infringing, there's a system to have it removed. And so obviously, if Google Search is linking to pirated content, then a rights owner can say to Google Search, oi, stop linking to that, and Google have a system to take it down. We know the rights owners have become very prolific in issuing these takedown notices in recent years. The music industry in particular have become very prolific on this. But the figures keep going up. And it was interesting, Torrent Freak pointed out, which was a very shrewd thing that they pointed out, and they're totally right to say this, that it's not just that the industry is getting ever more prolific in issuing these takedowns. There's other reasons why the number has gone up.
Yes. Well, as web blocking has grown and the music industry and film industry goes after the whole domains, you know, blocking access to them ISP level, file sharing websites increasingly operate at multiple domains, so that if one's taken down, then they can just move on to another one, and they don't, you know, as long as people know where to find it, there's not too much shift in service. But that also means that there are multiple mirrors of the same content that's being made available illegally, which means you have to issue more takedown notices for the same thing, which means, you know, you get to a point where Google is processing 23 a second. Whereas that, which is up from, we worked at 4 years ago, they were doing 185,000 a week. So that's quite an increase in quite a short space of time.
It is. And I suppose one of the frustrations on the music industry side is that Google insists when you take down, you have to be very specific with the URL. You can't just say everything on the Pirate Bay or, you know, every One Direction track on the Pirate Bay.
You have to say, I own this file.
Yes. Yeah. http://blah, blah, blah. So if you have a piracy service that links to the same bit of content through 30 different manifestations of its domain name, then now you have to submit all 30 URLs. So it's one bit of piracy work over here is increasing this other bit of piracy work over here. And I mean, to be fair, Google, you know, they keep publishing these numbers. Part of you wonders, the fact they're publishing them possibly shows that they're moaning about it slightly. Or it may well be that, you know, referencing our safe harbour conversation, Google like to position themselves as we're doing everything we can about piracy.
Look how many takedowns we're doing.
Look how hard we're working. But, you know, the record companies would say, well, the reason those figures are so ludicrously high is because of this, you know, you have to have the complete URLs. In the UK, a judge has said that the Pirate Bay is a copyright infringing website. Why don't you, Mr. Google, remove every single link from your search engine that has anything to do with the Pirate Bay? Because a court of law has said that, you know, it will be copyright infringing content. Google don't want to do that, and so they don't do that. And so the flip side of that, therefore, is these massive long lists of domains and multiple takedown notices. But it was a fun stat. People seem to like that stat. It got tweeted quite a lot.
Well, who doesn't like a good stat?
So there you go. Let's make that stat of the week. That could be a new feature on the show.
All right, yeah, stat of the week. Create a jingle, Matt. Just drop that in there.
OK, back to CMU Approved now on the CMU podcast. Andy Malt with four more artists slash tracks that he thinks you should go and check out. Let's talk through them one by one. Let's start off with Connie Constance.
Connie Constance. Her real name is Constance Power. That's probably not relevant to you, but it's a nice, you know, bit of information for you.
Well, it's interesting that her real name is sort of more entertainment than the name that she's performing
under. That's true, yeah. Anyway, she has a single out called Stars, or Coming Out. It's her debut single. It's produced by Blue Daisy, who is a producer also CMU approved in the past, or I think pre-podcast, so we haven't discussed him before. And together they've created this. It's a really good track. It's a kind of, the music is sort of kind of these broad strokes of kind of electronic pop that then kind of underpin her vocals and lyrics, which are all about kind of escaping your real life into a fantasy world, which the video then mirrors very entertainingly.
It's a shame this isn't a video podcast, because A, people could appreciate my haircut and appreciate that that was a good alternative to me getting this interview from that bakery. They could also see how that you sort of mimed a brush, as you said the word brush.
Yeah.
I thought that was quite nice. But
in my head, they are brushy. I do they are. Tend to think of music quite visually, so that I...
There you go.
I imagined them okay. as brushes. That's well, why I was doing that.
Duke Spirit is the next approved. Are you doing this in mime, or are you going to use words to describe this one?
We'll see. Okay. We'll see. The Duke Spirit, you've probably heard of them. 10 years ago, they were the hot thing on the block. And then, well, like so many bands, the shine sort of wore off and people moved on to other bands.
They petered off.
And to a point that I would say a week ago, if you'd have asked me about the Duke Spirit, I would have said, oh, I used to like them. It's a shame they split up. But they haven't split up. They're coming back. They got a new album out next year. The first track from it they released this week. It's called Here Comes the Vapor. And it's been, they had a quote from vocalist Leela Moss in the press release where she basically said, yeah, we had to go away and sort of work out what we were doing again. We needed to refresh ourselves. And that's what they've done. They've come back with this 6-minute track that's really good. And it's definitely a kind of a progression of their sound rather than, I mean, they could have gone back to something like their first album was quite raw and urgent. And this is not that, but it's really good. Worth checking out. Worth reacquainting yourself with the Duke Spirit.
Lion Face is next.
Someone else who is quite raw and heavy. It's a project fronted by Kim Marsh, who used to be in King Blues. It's got a guitar from Martin Gretsch, who you might also remember for actually more than 10 years ago now. I think he was I think it's unfair to call him a one-hit wonder, but he sort of was. But his first albums both very good, and he's still going. Still going. I was going to write in my approved column, no one really knows whatever happened to him. And then I looked and he's done loads. So people must know that he's still doing stuff. But it's the first release from Lion Face for a couple of years. There's a new EP coming out later this month. And it's really kind of, it ramps up. It really kind of hardens their hard edges. It brings Kim Marsh's kind of vocals more to the fore, kind of pushes them more up front. And it really works very well. It's also worth checking out, which I don't. I always say that.
You do always say that.
That's sort of the point of this section, is that they're all worth checking out.
But good mime of pushing up there. So I enjoyed that. Magical Clouds is our final approved.
Magical Clouds, some inventive spelling that you won't get the benefit of in this audio format, but you'll have, just go and look that up for yourselves. This is, I think, the second track from their second album. It's called Silver Car Crash. Actually, I think the audio of this track was released a little while ago, but a video for it has just come out this week. And it's good. It's descriptively similar to where we started with Connie Constance. It's sort of the music is quite. I'm going to brush the other way. Broad brushes from top left to bottom right this time, if you're following along at home. And then, again, quite inventive, playful lyrics that kind of that play with your expectations, I think, is fair to say. And so it's very much worth checking out.
Go check it out.
Do check it out.
CompleteMusicUpdate.com/...
Approved. Back to things that piss off the publishing industry now. And we're going to talk about consent decrees, which is a quirk, like so many, of US copyright law.
Yes, this is more collective licensing, which we always like to talk about on the CMU podcast. So collective licensing, wherever you are in the world, is generally regulated in a way that direct licensing is not. So if the music industry decides to license radio or live or whatever as one, then the deals and the rates that are being set in those deals are subject to extra law, extra regulation. In the US, that regulation comes through these things called consent decrees. And basically, they cover the two big performing rights organisations for music publishers and songwriters in America.
Because, yes, unlike the UK where you just have PRS for music, there are competing organisations.
And the big two.
ASCAP and BMI.
And so they both have consent decrees from the Department of Justice in America, which basically say, OK, we will allow you to license collectively. The reason why collective licensing always has extra regulation is because of the competition law concerns of collective licensing.
Which we mentioned last week or another week.
So if lots and lots and lots and lots of music rights owners license as one, there's a fear that that could be anti-competitive. They could exploit their monopoly. And so these extra regulations are there to try and stop that. And as I say, in the US, BMI has a consent decree and ASCAP has a consent decree. Now, the consent decrees were written a very long time ago. And although they've been slightly amended over the years, the music publishers in the US and indeed songwriters in the US are very much of the opinion that they are no longer fit for purpose.
Well, like
That's
so
a
many
nine,
things.
Isn't it? No longer fit for purpose.
Well, like so many things in the modern music industry, it's governed by stuff that was written before today's digital services were even an apple in anyone's eye.
Yeah, that almost works.
Yeah.
So, yes, there are various things that the music publishers and the songwriters would like to see changed in the consent decree to bring them up to date for this digital age. Although the biggie is that the big publishers would like to start licensing services like Pandora directly rather than through the collective licensing system, which has happened over here in Europe. Not with Pandora, obviously, because they don't operate over here. But here in Europe, the big publishers have started licensing digital services directly, albeit through very complicated joint ventures with the collecting societies, but we don't need to talk about that. Well, all you need to know is that in Europe, there is some flexibility for the owners of song copyrights, that sometimes they license collectively and sometimes they license directly, just like the record companies do. In the US, when the big publishers said, well, we want to do the same thing, we want to start licensing directly to Pandora, mainly because by licensing directly, they get rid of the regulations that regulate collective licensing, which strengthens their negotiating hand, which means ultimately they can get more money. So that's why the publishers want to license directly. And when the publishers tried to do that in the US, a court said, hang on a second, according to the BMI and ASCAP consent decrees, there's a rule. And the rule is you either license everything collectively or nothing collectively. So the digital services actually have a choice. They could go and do direct deals if they wanted to. But the rule is, as a rights owner, once you're in the collective licensing system, you have to offer all licenses through the collective licensing system or none. And so the publishers don't like that. They want to have a situation like they've got over here in Europe where they could carry on licensing radio and live and cafes and bars through BMI and ASCAP, but start doing direct deals with the digital services. So they want the consent decrees rewritten. Department of Justice said, all right then, we'll review the consent decrees. They're halfway through doing that. We suspect that that biggie, you know, the partial withdrawal, so that they can start to license Pandora directly while continuing to license everybody else collectively, we suspect the Department of Justice are going to allow that when they rewrite the consent decrees. But now they're rewriting consent decrees, they're rewriting consent decrees. And it turns out that some of the things they're planning on rewriting, the publishers ain't so happy about.
Yeah, so this week, Sony ATV boss Marty Bandier wrote to Nashville-based songwriters to encourage them to attend a meeting of the National Music Publishers Association in the city to oppose one such change known as 100% licensing, which basically is, as we just, you know, as I said, you've got different performing rights organisations in the US. So if a song is written by more than one person,
Which they often are,
one of those songwriters might be with ASCAP, one of them might be with BMI. And let's say there's two songwriters on this song for ease, and it's split 50-50. Currently, you'd have to go to both PROs in order to get your licence. However, under this proposal, you'd be able to go to just one of them, and if they agree to licence it, then you wouldn't just get the 50%, you'd automatically get the 100%, and that's that.
Yes, so you could go to ASCAP and say, you only have 50% of this song, but we'll agree a deal, we'll pay you some money, you can give us 100% license, you just then have to give half the money over to ASCAP to pass on to the other songwriter.
Yeah.
So it's a concept called 100% licensing. Now, it's not a brand new concept. Actually, technically speaking, under US copyright law, away from collective licensing, so let's talk about, say, a sync deal, technically under American copyright law, this principle already exists. So if you have a song that is co-written and six people co-wrote it, so six publishers are involved in negotiating a sync deal, whereas over here in Europe, you'd have to go and do a deal with all six people, In theory, in America, any one of the six can do a deal on behalf of everybody and then divvy up the money. And so you don't have to go and get separate deals from all of them. In theory. However, by convention, lots of songwriters and lots of publishers, when they co-write and co-publish, have agreements that basically render that principle redundant. So if you speak to sync people in the US, actually, in most cases, they do have to go and get agreements from everybody. And actually, I was talking to a sync person who specializes in US recently, and they were saying, even when you suspect that one of the rights owners could do the complete deal, because there isn't a contract that stops that from happening, and the basic principle is that you can do 100% license with one person, the studios would never do it anyway, because they're sort of paranoid that if they were to do that, then one of those rights owners would suddenly come along and say, hey, we've got a piece of paper here that says that deal wasn't allowed to happen, and it would all be a mess. So, although in principle 100% licensing occurs elsewhere in America, actually often it doesn't. So that's what the publishers are now saying, which is, well, you're taking a principle which actually doesn't really happen over here, and now you're trying to expand it and apply it to PROs over here. And so we think that's a really bad idea, is what they were saying.
So Marty Banya's email basically said, it was sort of a divide and conquer approach, where he was saying, well, you know, if they let this happen, then your performing rights organisation is great, but the other one, oh, terrible. They'll probably do a terrible deal for you, and then you're not only getting less money than you would have done with your PRO, but you've also got to rely on them to collect money, and they probably won't manage to do it. They're probably terrible at it.
And of course, the issue for Sony ATV is that if this was part of the reform, so let's say the new consent decree allowed partial withdrawal but introduced this 100% licensing thing in collective licensing, what it would mean is if Pandora comes to Sony ATV and tries to do a direct deal but can't agree a deal, well, any song that Sony ATV controls but it doesn't control it outright, which will be a lot of songs, they could go and get their BMI deal and still use all of that Sony catalogue, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So that's why the big publishers are like, yeah, you're going to give us partial withdrawal, but then you're going to introduce 100% licensing, which basically screws up the power of the partial withdrawal. So they're very much against this move. And it was interesting that the letter said, please come to this meeting if you're Nashville-based, we're having a meeting, come along and we'll explain what this means. But actually, the letter had already explained what it meant. And, you know, given that copyright things are often quite complicated, it was explained in quite a clear way in the letter. I think a lot of, you know, even songwriters who have no interest in this, I think would pretty much get their head around it. So I think it was more, come along to this meeting because we want you to get involved so that we can go to the Department of Justice and say, it isn't just us, the big bad publishers.
We'll take a picture.
Yeah, look at all these songwriters. I don't know, perhaps they think that, I'm sort of assuming that songwriters based in Nashville will be a certain sort of songwriter, which is possibly unfair. But perhaps they think that the Department of Justice or the people who work there are mainly fans of songwriters who are based in Nashville.
Well, I think that might be a fair thing to say.
So they want, yeah, you say photos of all these songwriters that they will have heard of saying, do not introduce this. Do rewrite. I mean, again, it was another one, a bit like the event I went to earlier this week in Westminster. It's, you know, the publishers have been banging on for months saying the consent decrees are broken, they need to be rewritten, they need to be fixed. And then it's like, oh, but don't fix that bit.
That bit's just fine.
That bit works great. There's no need to change that bit. So it will be interesting to see if this is on the proposals that Department of Justice actually go with down the line, and whether or not the publishers with their Nashville songwriters in tow can stop this particular change.
Just time to quickly look over some of the stories we didn't have time to squeeze into this edition of the CMU podcast, although we are now squeezing them in. Anyway, you know what I mean. Let's start with, there's two Bon Jovi shows in China have been cancelled.
It was the first time the band were ever going to play there, wasn't it?
Yeah, and now looks like they might never play there.
Because they're Dalai Lama fans.
Well, possibly. There's no official reason given for the cancellation, except that it's happened. However, it is thought that the Chinese Culture Ministry found a video of Bon Jovi performing in Taiwan, I think about 4 or 5 years ago, in which their video backdrop featured images of the Tiananmen Square and the Dalai Lama, both of which are things that the Chinese government would rather people didn't see.
And of course, gigs in China need a license from government to go ahead. So they're not going ahead.
No, and it's not, I mean, it's not, this isn't the first time this has happened in recent times. Maroon 5 had a show cancelled in, I think, Shanghai earlier this year.
Which some people would just say is a good idea.
Which is a good idea. I mean, all Maroon 5 shows should be cancelled. But this one was cancelled after Adam Levine tweeted a happy birthday message to the Dalai Lama. Didn't go down very well.
And of course, Bjork annoyed them. She was actually performing in China
when she got to China. She did the show in 2008 and she shouted Tibet, Tibet at the end of a song, which got her a lifetime ban.
So there you go. No Bon Jovi in China.
No Bon Jovi in China.
But the Foo Fighters are playing the UK, or actually, I think by the time this podcast goes out, they did play the UK.
They did play the UK,
which I assume are the rescheduled dates from when he knackered his ankle or whatever
it was. Yeah, they came back, didn't they?
Yeah.
But that's not the story.
No, it's not the story.
The story is Spotify sent out an email to Foo Fighters fans or listeners to Foo Fighters who had listened to a certain level of their music.
Yes, so Spotify sent out an email to people who had been listening to Foo Fighters on their service, plugging the gigs, and there was a competition, and people could win merch. And the reason why this is interesting is, as far as we're aware, it's the first artist-specific marketing that Spotify have done. So Spotify send out emails to their subscribers, you know, with playlists and plugging Spotify initiatives, but this was the first one we're aware of where they've particularly picked people who listen to a certain artist and then, in collaboration with that artist, have then sent out a plugging email.
Yeah, and this is something actually, it did come up at the CMU at the Great Escape.
It did indeed, when we had Will Hope from Spotify there and Sammy Andrews from Cooking Vinyl said on the panel, well, something that I would like as a marketing person at label is, you know who's listening to what music, could we not collaborate on things? And Will said, well, we like to work with artists on stuff like that, but then again, we don't want Spotify customers to be getting 82 emails a day from every single artist they've ever listened to, but it is something that we're looking at. And so clearly they looked at it and it's now happening. So yeah, that's interesting that Spotify, how common this will be, when I think it was Music Ally asked for a quote from Spotify and they were just like, yeah, we do stuff. So I don't know whether this is going to become a common thing, whether it was an experiment, but it's interesting that that is something they have done.
Talking about streaming services doing work, sort of works as a segue, an Apple Music exec, Oliver Schusser, has admitted that Apple Music needs a bit of work.
Technically, he oversees iTunes, doesn't he? So he's slightly one step removed from the Apple Music service itself. But yes, he was saying that we're constantly improving it. We launched in all of these territories. We're getting feedback. We're aware that it's not perfect.
Well, he was saying actually that, you know, if you launch simultaneously in 110 different countries, you get a lot of feedback and that's a lot of kind of information to be working with to improve the service. Which is, you know, it's good. You should constantly be improving the service.
Fair enough. He seemed to think that Apple Connect was really taking off. I'm not quite sure what his definition of taking off is.
I looked at Apple Connect the other day, just because I hadn't since the day it launched, and it was almost all Ellie Goulding. I don't even know how I was following Ellie Goulding.
Clearly, they think you're an Ellie Goulding fan. So who knows?
Well, apparently, Ellie Goulding is... Maybe that's what he means by it's taking off. It's like Ellie Goulding is using it a lot.
She is seriously on it. Of course, Apple Music at the end of this month, the free trial will end for those people who signed up on day one and people have stopped paying for it. So lots of Apple Music marketing expected in the next few weeks as people are having to start paying for it. And yeah, the service apparently is going to get better. So that's good.
All right.
I'm a big Apple Music fan.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
Coco in Camden, live music news now, has scored a legal win, which is a sort of an unusual legal win in that it went to court after planning permission was granted for a residential development nearby, next door, I think,
or more or less
opposite. And has managed to get that planning permission revoked.
Yes, so this sort of fits into this ongoing story in the grassroots live sector where you get rundown bits of town, a venue or several venues open, suddenly it becomes cool and creative, and then suddenly property developers come in and they fix up a load of buildings, turn them into flats, and then people move into those flats and they say, oh, we don't want noise, we don't want music. Shut all of this creative stuff, which is the only reason we moved here, down. And so that's an issue that's been talked about a lot. And so, yes, it's a pub quite near Coco. The proposal was to put an extra few stories on it, turn it into flats. Camden Council gave it approval earlier in the year. But in court, the judge said, actually, when the councillors discussed this proposal, they were not made aware of how close to Coco it was or of the issues that have been raised. And they should have been made aware of that. They've sort of criticising the planning officials who had done all the paperwork. And so they've quashed the planning permission, which means it has to go back to Camden Council. It doesn't mean that it can't happen. It just means that Camden Council has to consider everything anew, which certainly delays things, but could ultimately result in planning not being given. So a little win for the, I don't know if Coco counts as the grassroots music community, really. It's quite a big venue.
No.
But anyway, it's an independent venue. It's a win for the live music community.
Speaking of winning, you could win an auction on eBay for Abs from Five's Best Newcomer Brit Award from 2000.
Although you, unless whoever put in the ridiculously high bid fesses up to the fact that they're not a real bidder, you need a lot of money to buy. It probably would be easier to go into the studio, release a record and win a Brit Award cheaper than to actually buy it at its current price point.
Yeah, because, Abs these days, more into farming than music, needs some topsoil. So he's selling his Brit Award, which he's currently using as a doorstop, on eBay. But yes, as you say, the bidding had topped £1 million within a day or so of it going live, which I think might be some people not being entirely genuine in their bids.
Despite him saying, you know, I'm desperate for the cash and this is a great opportunity. Didn't he say something like that was quite funny? Sort of, this is an opportunity for you to take advantage of my poverty and getting yourself. Did they win Best Newcomer?
Best Newcomer 2000.
So there you go.
Great days.
So
he also said that Jason Statham had held it, although he couldn't prove this.
So perhaps that's what got it up for a million.
That's what got it up over a million, yeah. Not selling his Brit Awards, although he's got enough of them, I'm sure he could get rid of one or two without noticing. Sam Smith is also not getting into farming. He is getting into recording Bond theme tunes.
Yeah.
That works as an intro to this,
doesn't it? I think that could win a Brit Award as the worst segue to ever. Not only on a CMU podcast, but any podcast.
Sam Smith recorded the Bond theme tune.
He has. And that's partly news, although you think the bigger news is that Sam Smith is a big, big, big fat liar.
I'm not the only person who thinks that, because the NME did a list of all the times Sam Smith had lied about recording the Bond theme tune. It was quite a plentiful list.
So the new Bond film is called
Spectre.
And he has recorded the song. It's not a last-minute thing at all.
No, he recorded it months ago.
He's been working on it for a long time. Recorded it months ago, finally announced this week, because the film's coming out soon and the record will come out just before it.
The film is coming out, yes. We're in the UK, 23rd of October, and the US, I think, 6th of November.
But he is claiming that he was sworn to secrecy by the studio.
Which I'm sure he was,
It's not just that he thought, ha-ha, here's an opportunity for me to lie for a year.
No, but he did give an interview to, the BBC, where he said, I'm really impressed with how good at lying I am.
And of course, at one point when he was trying, well, in that BBC interview, he denied he'd done this, I think. But at one point when he was trying to distract some pesky journalist who was saying, you're doing the Bond theme, doing the Bond theme, doing the Bond theme, he said, oh, I'm not doing it. I think Ellie Goulding
is
doing
it. He's done it at least twice. He's claimed that Ellie Goulding was doing it.
So then all the attention then went on to Ellie Goulding, who I'm sure was talking about it on Apple Connect daily. It's just that no one saw that. But that was just a distraction tactic.
Well, then there was a whole thing where she posted, it seemed like, you know, conspiracy theory would be that she was in on this with Sam Smith, because she posted a picture of herself leaving Abbey Road Studios with the caption, that's a wrap, which people took to mean that she'd just recorded the Bond theme.
And not that she'd just recorded a wrap.
which might also have done.
Which, if we used Apple Connect, we'd know all about the Ellie Goulding rap record that's coming out.
But no, it was Sam Smith all along. The song's called Writings on the Wall. It's coming out on the 25th of September. It's claimed to be a classic Bond theme.
I wonder how they decide, because sometimes the Bond themes are the name of the film.
Sometimes.
And then other times, I wonder how they decide that. I think I prefer my Bond themes to be named after the film.
Well, I think it probably depends on
the writing process. Couldn't think of any rhymes for Spectre. So
yeah, Deflector. Reflector.
Oh, perhaps they should have got you to do the Bond theme.
Collector. There's loads of rhymes. Come on, Sam. Oh, Writings on the Wall is a terrible name.
It is.
Spectre, call it that.
That's what I would have called it. Now, the last Bond theme was Adele.
Yep, Skyfall.
Everyone liked that. I wasn't a big fan of it myself. I thought it was a bit lame.
I didn't like it until I saw the film in the cinema. It really worked in the cinema.
Did it? Did
you
it?
Had to hear, oh, I had to hear it in the cinema.
Yeah, I watched Best the film place. On the TV.
Yeah, no point. No point.
With quite a few interruptions. So perhaps that's why.
No, you really need to see it in the cinema.
That's why.
Otherwise,
I mean,
that song doesn't make any sense.
Best ever Bond theme?
Best ever Bond theme. Goldfinger.
Goldfinger. You think Goldfinger's the best?
Yeah.
You're not down with the Living Daylights by Aha.
It's a good one.
It is a good one. It is a good one. But, well, I haven't yet heard Sam Smith. Have we actually heard it yet, or have we just got a name?
No, 25th of September.
Okay, so we'll hold off.
Hold your horses.
Hold off judgment, despite him not naming it after the film, ignoring all of the plentiful rhymes he could have employed. It may as yet be the best ever Bond theme, so we'll hold
off. I'm sure it will be. It won't be Radiohead's Bond theme, though.
No.
Them being the other. See, Ellie Goulding and Sam Smith were the ones that I think the bookies' favourites to do it. But Radiohead were also in the mix.
Albeit last minute.
And that... Oh, no, there was rumours that they were doing it for a long time.
Were there?
But people were clinging on to that theory right up to the last minute when this week... A composer who's working with Radiohead currently, Robert Ziegler, tweeted some pictures from the studio, including one of them recording with an orchestra, which loads of people seem to think meant that Radiohead were definitely doing the Bond theme.
Yeah, because why else would they be working with an orchestra?
At that point, Sam Smith had already tweeted a picture of a ring with the film's logo on it, which would be a weird thing to tweet if you weren't doing the Bond theme. But people were still like, yes, Radiohead, definitely.
But sometimes they have...
Radiohead is just recording an album, which...
Sometimes they have a second theme for the final credits, don't they?
So
perhaps that could be Radiohead and Ellie Goulding rapping
yes.
to Tom York's Wailing.
I'm sure that is what's happening.
If that's what's happening, I will definitely go and see Spectre in the
cinema. I'm going to go and put a bet on that.
Rather than watching it on
ITV.
As soon
as we leave here. So I better go and do that now.
Christmas 2018. Hey... Why don't you do that bit that you do at the end of the podcast?
So, yeah, I need to go and put my bet on.
Subscribe to the podcast, review and rate us on iTunes. It says so in the script.
Yeah, yeah. Do you want to...
Share the podcast far and wide, follow us on Twitter. Go on, do it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Subscribe, review, rate on iTunes, but, you know, anywhere. Share it, social media and that. Follow us at CMU, Complete Music Update. And this was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more information on CMU, you can go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.